From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on Sunday in the pages of Germany's newspaper of record, the Frankfurter Allgemeine, comparable to perhaps the New York Times, and apologies if I butchered the pronunciation. But the bottom line is the German paper evaluated President Donald Trump's trip abroad and concluded that Trump compares unfavorably to a five-year-old child. Now, that's just one view. But it's worth asking what the result of the president's first foreign trip will be, particularly with our closest allies. Angela Merkel said this past weekend that the times in which Germany and Europe could rely on the United States are somewhat over. She was referring specifically to the lack of U.S. commitment to address climate change, but she was also sending a powerful message more broadly. Well, this hour, we asked University of Rochester professor Randy Stone to come in and share what he learned watching this trip, really. He's the director of the Skolnick Center for Polish and Central European Studies and has regular meetings with Russian colleagues in particular. We think he's well-suited to evaluate this trip, and there are plenty of questions. So, Randy Stone, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
How did I do on the pronunciation? The Frankfurter...
Allgemeine.
Allgemeine. Okay.
The Frankfurt General.
The Frankfurt General. Yeah. And the comparison was to roughly to a five-year-old child, but a five-year-old child might compare better, is what they're saying.
That's right. Now, just to be clear, that wasn't Angela Merkel's comment. That was the editorial.
Yeah, that's the newspaper.
In the newspaper, and they led with a story about a five-year-old child who comes home and complains. You know, the kid was beating me up in class, and the father is a good liberal father, and so says, "Oh, I hope you didn't hit back." And so finally, he said, "No, of course not. We don't do that." But in private, perhaps the father is wishing that, you know, maybe he had let him have one. You know, and so that's kind of the way the Europeans are feeling after their encounter with Donald Trump. But then they went on to say, the five-year-old comes off pretty badly in the comparison, right? That you know, that actually the average five-year-old behaves himself pretty well. So that was the comment. So there's a sense that Donald Trump did not make a favorable impression upon the Europeans during this trip.
And there's a lot of different directions that I'd like to go, but I'd like to start with NATO, because we've talked with you, especially in the last year, a number of times about what Donald Trump's, first his campaign itself, what that might do to undermine NATO, even if he had won or lost, but now what it means. And let's start with Article 5. Remind our listeners what Article 5 is.
So Article 5 is the portion of the NATO treaty, the North Atlantic Treaty, which commits all the members to regard as an attack on any of them as an attack on all of them. And it's only been invoked once, which was after the September 11th attack on the United States.
You have some disagreement out there as to whether President Trump affirmed or essentially stepped away from Article 5 on his trip. David Frum is a former speechwriter for George W. Bush. He's now a senior editor for The Atlantic. And in his assessment of Trump's trip, among other things, he said that what Trump did was essentially disavow Article 5 in ways that it would be unimaginable for predecessors, including Bush and Obama. And he said that it was such a disavowal of Article 5 that Putin himself couldn't have written a better speech for Trump to deliver in various places on this trip. Do you agree with Frum?
I would agree. I think that what he said was the unthinkable in U.S. foreign policy. Since 1948, it's been the basis of American security policy and, frankly, of international security, that the United States is absolutely committed to coming, legally committed to coming to the aid of our allies if they're attacked. And I think he was very deliberate in avoiding making that commitment. He practices a kind of transactional politics, right, where I'll scratch your back if you scratch mine. He thinks of this as something to hold out as a carrot to get the Europeans to make some concessions on other issues. And perhaps he doesn't realize the sort of the fundamental damage that he's doing to the alliance by doing this. But it shocked Europeans that in this setting, at a meeting of NATO, he would publicly distance himself from that avowal.
They were at NATO's, I think, their new headquarters for a memorial unveiling, a memorial to Article 5 itself. And So what the White House is now saying, and what H.R. McMaster, National Security Advisor, are saying is, no, you guys have got it wrong, that Trump did affirm Article 5. They point to the essentially the one quote he had about it, which it was, you know, we will always stand with our friends. You know, it was nowhere near the specific support for Article 5 that we saw from Barack Obama and George W. Bush, for example, talking specifically about Article 5, talking about legal commitments, talking about historic commitments. Trump said, well, we'll always stand with our friends. But McMaster saying, that's not disavowing Article 5, and we're getting it wrong here. Is he wrong? Is that damage control?
That's damage control. I mean, and McMaster clearly disagrees with Trump about this. So does Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State. And they have been publicly and privately reassuring everyone that Trump doesn't really mean what he says about Article 5 and about the NATO commitment. Trump really does mean what he says, I think, that our commitment is... it's something that we can take or leave, and it's up to him whether or not to follow through if NATO allies are attacked, and so I think it's a good thing that McMaster is trying to take it back. It's possible that they can walk this back sufficiently that it doesn't do as much damage, right? But I think it's hard to undo without a big apology and without Donald Trump coming forward and saying, oh, well, I didn't ever mean it. I always intended to abide by our legal commitments. It's going to be very difficult to repair the breach.
Okay. And so let's talk about why there is damage, because some would argue, okay, Professor Stone, you've got this concern that the American president goes to Europe and doesn't even affirm Article 5, and that is, you know, leaving that work to his subordinates, to Rex Tillerson, to McMaster, but they believe in it. And if the chips were down, some would argue we're not going to walk away from it, that we would be there. Does his rhetoric open the door for Putin to be more aggressive? What damage do you foresee as a possibility?
No, absolutely. I mean, there are two kinds of damage. One is it damages the credibility of the U.S. guarantee vis-a-vis our allies, right? And so our allies now feel insecure, and they have to respond in some way. So on Sunday after the G7 summit, so first they had the NATO summit, then they had the G7 summit, Angela Merkel had spent about 3 days with Donald Trump. And what she said on Sunday was, die Zeiten, in denen wir völlig auf andere verlassen könnten, die sind ein Stück vorbei. So what that means is the times in which we could completely rely on others, they are more or less over. Now, German foreign policy since 1945 has been based on relying on the West. We're not going to have to rebuild our military. We're not going to develop a nuclear weapon. We're not going to try to play power politics. We are going to be a junior partner. And that has reassured all the Europeans. The Germans didn't have to be the leading military power in Europe because the United States was committed to doing that, right? And so as a result, Germany and France were able to work together with great cooperation over the last 70 years. The other danger is what it does to perceptions on the Russian side. And the Russians are already very skeptical of U.S. commitments to defend allies, particularly the new NATO allies in the East. And particularly they mention Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, which are three former republics of the Soviet Union who joined NATO in the late 1990s. Those countries clearly can't defend themselves against the Russian army. I was in a meeting a few weeks ago with Russians in which they emphasized that, a recent RAND assessment that Russia would be able to occupy all those territories within a few days if it came to war. And so the only thing preventing Russian aggression against those countries is the NATO guarantee. They have very tense relationship with all those countries. Those countries are pretty intensely anti-Russian in their orientation because of their intense memories of what happened under Stalin during World War II. And they are on the front line. right? And so the Russians don't believe that the United States would really intervene if they chose to attack those countries. And these kinds of statements of distancing ourselves from a legal commitment muddy the waters. They make things fuzzy, right? And that's inherently very dangerous because it could lead to escalation. We did that in Korea, right? Dean Acheson famously gave a speech where he drew the U.S. Strategic defense perimeter and he left out South Korea in 1950. And then that led to the Korean War because there was then uncertainty about whether the United States would defend South Korea. It turned out we would. We didn't know we would, but it turned out we did. And you can imagine escalation happening in a similar sort of way in Eastern Europe. So it's very important that these commitments be very clear.
And then think about the terrible two choices there. If Putin and Russia view this as an open door to aggression regarding Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, then you've got two things that could happen. Number one, we do not fulfill our commitment, and then Article 5 is essentially toast, and NATO is entirely redefined, and we show no commitment to allies, and that's a huge, huge issue. Or we end up in a war with Russia that was provoked by our waffling on whether we would fulfill it. So there's two terrible options there.
Right. No, those are both disastrous outcomes.
Yeah.
I think the war outcome would be more likely in that scenario. But the Russians think that the other outcome would be more likely. And the Russians would love to see that outcome happen.
Talking to Randy Stone, if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. Toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. By the way, in that meeting a few weeks ago with the Russians that I don't know if you can divulge who you were meeting with, but I think you told me before the program began, they are convinced that Russia did not, you know, effectively throw the U.S. election or you know, didn't have the power to be that meddlesome, probably had some rooting interest for the Trump campaign and maybe assisted where they could, but they didn't pull the levers that much that they couldn't. Is that right?
That's right. The group, I can say that the leader of the group on the Russian side is Sergei Karaganov, who's dean of the Higher School of Economics in Moscow. It's mostly academics, but also some policy people. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those folks do consulting for the Kremlin. So they're pretty well connected. It's hard to tell exactly who knows what and who knows whom and so forth. But whenever we go to Moscow, we get access to very high-level officials. So I think they're pretty well connected. And it's interesting meeting with them because they're a pretty good barometer of the current thinking in the Kremlin about foreign policy. What they said about the election was fascinating. They roundly deny that Russia had any role in the election, in the hacking into the Democratic National Committee, in spreading disinformation through social media, all these sorts of things, and all of this has been pretty well documented now. So it's a remarkable thing in a meeting with people that you've been meeting with regularly for 7 years to deny, you know, that the sky is blue and that the earth goes around the sun. It was remarkable. And at one point, one of them did say that, you know, if we had the capability, we would have done it, because they really didn't want to see Hillary Clinton elected, and they thought that Donald Trump would be much more pro-Russian. If we had the capability, we would have done it, but we don't have that capability.
Okay.
All right.
You buy that?
No. I mean, I buy that they did have the motivation, right? And they don't make any bones about the fact that they had the motivation to do it. But they clearly have the capability to hack, you know, a relatively soft site like the Democratic National Committee website, and to spread a lot of misinformation on the social media. It's also clear that they intervened in the French election unsuccessfully. They are pushing kind of extremist candidates in the upcoming Italian election, which is much more worrisome. They've got a full court press to try to undermine Europe and undermine U.S. ties with Europe.
What do you make of a lot of the comparisons between Trump and Macron, who yesterday, Emmanuel Macron, was with Vladimir Putin, and right there standing next to Putin, declared that Russia today for example, is a propaganda organization mm-hmm. that has irresponsibly spread fake news for the benefit of Russia. That's why he rejects it and wants to see, you know, better standards. He says this with Putin right there, and a lot of people said that was guts. That's what a leader does. And now they're comparing that to Donald Trump and his rhetoric regarding Putin and what a lot of people view, I think you as well, as a foreign policy trip for Trump that Putin probably would have loved. Is that a fair comparison?
Well, I think, yeah, Macron came off much better from this weekend than Donald Trump or Putin. And he had the famous handshake with Donald Trump that she apparently got the better of. And Donald Trump has been, you know, pushing and pulling people around and being a, you know, acting like a schoolyard bully with world leaders. And Macron was prepared for it. And apparently he crushed Trump's hand. So,
which is an amazing thing that we're sitting here talking about. But that's where we are.
That's right.
And Trump has, you know, he does. He makes a show of that kind of dominance. So that was an interesting little optic moment. Yeah,
that's right. You know, the Europeans, you know, said, well, it's kind of a shame that you have to be macho to get, you know, to deal with Donald Trump. But probably that's the best way to respond to Donald Trump, right? That we have to be tougher. We have to stand up to America. We can't just go along with anything America proposes. We've got to really resist. And this is something he's brought on himself. Now, usually an American president can count on a lot of deference from our European allies. You know, they'll go along with things they don't like, and they'll be quiet usually if they really don't like something. They'll be supportive even when they're kind of reluctant. So, you know, George W. Bush was able to get Tony Blair to go along and support the Iraq War in 2003, which Tony Blair didn't want to do. He knew it was politically very risky, but he was Prime Minister of Great Britain at the time, and he knew he was putting his career in risk. As it turned out, he ended up dooming his career and dooming the Labour Party to at least a decade of irrelevance it's been a decade and a half already since then, because he followed the U.S. lead. You can count on an awful lot of that kind of soft power as the U.S. president. You know, Donald Trump is, you know, trying to wring a little bit more defense spending out of our allies and putting everything in play in order to do that. And the effect is that if he really needs something, he's not going to have any allies that are willing to put themselves at political risk in order to support him.
Let me grab our first phone call. It's Pete in Rochester on with Randy Stone, the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. Go ahead, Pete.
Clearly said it was Keith.
Oh, hi, Keith. Go ahead, Keith.
There's a maxim that says that generals fight future wars using the strategies and tactics of the last war. Russia is in no position to send its armor columns crashing through to the English Channel in the blitzkrieg way that the Nazis did. Like with Estonia, Russia will use electronic warfare. So instead of everyone beating up on the Donald, all of the free countries, the Western civilization, we should come together and know what is going to be facing us, computer and electronic and pulse wave warfare from the likes of Russia and China. But this whole idea that I'm getting from the guest, and he does sound a bit that he is beating up on the Trumpster. I think certainly when it comes to Angela Merkel, she was used to dealing with a passive, complying Obama, and here we have an alpha male going to Europe and saying, I just got through saying to our Saudi allies that they're going to have to drive the Islamists out of their midst. You and Europe, likewise, are going to have to come to your own defense. The United States is $20 trillion in debt. And that's just with our known obligations. Really, we're close to $115 trillion in debt. What is the problem with asking the Europeans, certainly when we are facing true modern warfare, for a clearinghouse of new ideas to keep Putin, who is more represents more of Tsarist Russia than the Stalinist Soviet state, we're going to have to meet the Russians and Chinese and North Koreans in cyber warfare, and that's the clearinghouse that ought to be brought together. But in closing, let's not beat up on Trump because he's the alpha male getting the attention of Europeans who have gone to sleep in this era of terrorism, and Trump is just trying to inject some realism into what the world is really facing, even if his tactics and strategy always aren't on the mark.
Okay. Thank you, Keith. Go ahead, Randy.
Well, Keith, there was a lot of really interesting stuff in there. I don't know if I got it all down. You're absolutely right that cyber warfare is the wave of the future, and the days of preparing for large-scale armor battles in Europe are over. Thank goodness the large-scale armor battles aren't on the horizon. If Russia had a much stronger army, you know, we would be going back to preparing for that sort of confrontation. But cyber warfare is very threatening. There's a lot of vulnerabilities. One thing that I learned at from meeting with American defense specialists recently was that at least the U.S. nuclear arsenal is completely safe from cyber warfare, which is reassuring. The reason that it's completely safe is because it's out of date, because they're still using 8-inch floppy disks. And so as a result, none of it's connected to the internet. That's actually kind of reassuring.
Yeah, it sure is.
It's old technology. Apparently, it works. You made a comparison of Obama and Trump, and I think there was a really interesting comparison last week. There was an event happening in Berlin called the Kirchentag, which is when all the Protestant churches come together in Germany once every 2 years, and Angela Merkel was there at the Brandenburg Gate, and Obama was there. And Obama got a rock star welcome, you know, as he always does when he goes to Europe. The reason that he got along so well with Europeans is they're on the same page and they're friends. They're working together. They've got common goals. You know, they want to prevent climate change. They want to work on terrorism. Right? They want to work on containing Russia. They want to promote trade and cooperative relations.
But Keith is saying that that Obama was sort of a patsy, that Merkel has to respect Trump more, and that, you know, that there is that Obama was not as interested in fighting terrorism and dealing with Russia.
Well, ask Angela Merkel who she respects. She has the greatest respect for Obama. They're friends. They get along. They didn't have anything to have conflict about.
Well, her cell phone, right?
Yeah, she did get upset about that. but they were able to smooth it over because, you know, the bottom line is that they're on the same side. Whereas when Donald Trump goes to Europe, he has to invent things to be mad at our allies about. You know, he invents the issue of German manipulating the euro, the trade dispute and so forth.
Well, hold on. And on the trade dispute, and Keith, we're trying to address all the points here. But on the trade dispute, I want to come back to that because Trump was attacking Germany for selling too many cars to the United States. I don't know if he's aware that a lot of the parts or a lot of the manufacturing is actually happening here. Mm-hmm. So, you know, automaking is sort of a global enterprise now, where just because a company is based in Germany or wherever it is doesn't necessarily mean that the cars are made there. But anyway.
No, that's true. It's almost all the BMWs and Mercedes that are sold in the United States are actually produced in the Carolinas. And it's just the part of the globalized production and distribution network. That's right. Then there was the question about his main objective, which seems to be to wring a little more defense spending out of the Europeans. And Trump, he obfuscates this issue and makes it very unclear. He makes it sound as if the Europeans owe the United States money, that the United States, that the Europeans have not upheld their treaty commitments. And those are both false claims. There is a 2% guideline that was adopted in 2006 and as a distant goal. And then in 2014, But in 2006, it was adopted by defense ministers. Right? This wasn't really a this wasn't at the political level. It was reaffirmed in 2014 after Russia seized the Crimea. And at that point, it was reaffirmed at the head of state or government level, right? So that was a more serious commitment. And since 2014, the Europeans have been increasing their defense spending. Now, not every country, not maybe quite as fast as the U.S. diplomats would like, but it's been a bipartisan effort on the U.S. side to get the Europeans to contribute a bit more to their defense. Now, that's separate from the issue of the NATO budget. Now, the NATO budget is only about $1.5 billion. So it's trivial in terms of defense spending. The United States contributes 22%. There's a GDP-based formula for that. Nobody's ever been in arrears in their contributions to the NATO budget, right? So that's the only way that anyone could owe anyone money. Now, the other of the NATO allies, only five are above this guideline of that they should spend 2% of their GDP on defense. All the rest are below that. But it was never a binding commitment. It was never written down in a treaty, right? So, the 2014 goal was that they should try to reach 2% by 2024. So it's even too early to say that they haven't met it yet.
Okay, and what about Keith's contention on, you know, he's trying to send a message on terrorism, and, you know, here's a place where Obama and Trump are very different. Obama goes to Saudi Arabia in 2009, in his first year, and not only talks about Islam and relationships with Islamic countries, Islam around the world, but the president at the time, President Obama, also talked about human rights. And the Saudis in particular didn't really like that. Mm-hmm. But Obama made points about human rights. Trump very explicitly on this trip said, you know, I'm not here to talk about you do you. I'm here because I want a partner against terrorism. And that is it. I mean, the day after Trump leaves, Saudi Arabia is talking about laws against atheism in their country and, you know, imprisoning people for not having certain religious faith. So Trump, this White House is just not interested in human rights as sort of an issue to talk about around the world. The Obama administration was, but Trump will tell you this was about a partner against terrorism and probably a partner against Iran, changing the disposition mm-hmm. regarding Iran. And Keith, it sounds like, is saying, look, as a Trump supporter, that's exactly what I wanted.
Yeah, I wouldn't put words in Keith's mouth, but it did seem like this was a sort of consistent part of, you know, this style of sort of transactional politics, that his objective, the Trump administration's objective in this trip to the Middle East was to get along well with a couple of key players, Saudi Arabia and Israel. And in both cases, they did that by giving the partner a lot of what they wanted. And they were treated very nicely as a result. But both of these countries have been junior partners to the United States all along. They depend much more on the United States than the United States does on them. So they will be respectful and cooperative and go along with what we want, even if we push them on some of our objectives. So no previous American president has felt that they had to not mention human rights when they were in Saudi Arabia before. But I think that's right, that Trump thought that that was something he's willing to give up. It's a principle that doesn't need to be upheld because there's something else that he's trying to get.
And David Frum in The Atlantic points out the irony that Trump is in Saudi Arabia while Iran is actually voting, having a real election. Now, granted, I'm not here to tell you that the clerics don't have some control over who the candidates are and mm-hmm. what happens there. But in Rouhani's re-election, yeah, in the closing days of the Iranian campaign, Rouhani was talking about more liberal domestic politics, and that helped him win a re-election. So they're actually voting, whereas in Saudi Arabia, you know, there's all kinds of legitimate concerns about an actual access to freedom, to voting, to democratic rights. But again, that's just not It's not on the radar of this president, which is, he may tell you, my job is not to police the world. And again, that's why in Keith, I hear somebody who is calling to say that there is some fatigue that the United States must police the world. And so I wonder if you think that this trip, which you have concerns about, maybe resonated with his supporters in a way that says, you don't get it. We don't want free trade. We want someone to tell Germany, let's get tough on trade deficits. Let's get tough on terrorism. Who cares about what Saudi Arabia's human rights record is? That's their business. Yeah, I think that there's probably some resonance with his supporters.
It's probably true that a number of his supporters kind of like the muscular style. And it's hard to have a conflict with your best friends, right? Unless you come up with something that you can argue about, right? And so he came up with some pretty contorted reasons for having disagreements with the NATO allies, and I suspect, that some of that plays well with people who don't really understand. These have been our very close partners for a very long time. We work very closely on things. If we really had serious disagreements, we would have already been working on them in the background. Any previous administration would be very careful to avoid having these sorts of things come out in a summit like this. They would have been trying to resolve them quietly in the background. That's not his style.
And one more quick question, and then we'll take a break and we'll get your phone calls in. There's been a lot of talk as well about Jared Kushner, the presidential son-in-law, trying to establish a back channel with Russia. And I am not an expert in back channels. Trump's defenders, including Hugh Hewitt for Town Hall, for example, said, look, Kissinger had a back channel and used it well. And why can't Jared Kushner? It's the same thing. Whereas Tom Nichols and other conservatives have said not the same thing. You cannot compare Kushner to Kissinger, and that is what an apologist would do, devoid of substance. Look, that's not my expertise. How do you view this matter, Andy?
Well, I mean, at the time that it was happening, Jared Kushner didn't have any legal authority to represent the United States, right? So negotiating with foreign powers at that point is kind of problematic to begin with. I don't think that there is anything illegal about the effort to create this back channel through Russian communications as opposed to doing it through the United States. What's odd about it is that the transition team has access to all of the secure communications channels of the U.S. government. And those channels provide all sorts of advantages. So if there is a secure communication that goes through those channels, it's documented. The U.S. government knows what is said. The Russian government knows what is said. If there subsequently is a dispute about what was said, you have career-appointed people who don't have any clear partisan affiliation who are prepared to swear under oath about what was actually said, right? So it's you do that for your own protection. In the case of a back channel, which is only under control of the Russian government, the Russians could completely manipulate what was said, and they could use it for blackmail. And so it's at the very least a very naive thing to try to do, because it puts you in a very weak position. But then that raises the question, why would you choose to do that? Evidently, the Trump transition team really didn't trust the Obama and government and perhaps thought that they were going to be taken advantage of in some way. But this is a risky thing to do. It makes you think that perhaps they had something that was illicit that they wanted to talk about. And that's why people are so concerned about it. Because what was it that they could only say in a room that only the Russian government could hear and that would be shielded from U.S. intelligence?
Can it compare to Kissinger?
So, I mean, Kissinger was the National Security Advisor and then the Secretary of State. He was fully empowered to negotiate on behalf of the United States at the time. And back channel just meant that he had a direct connection with someone in the Russian government that he could communicate to rather than going through a whole series of his of his deputies. It's a completely different situation.
Okay. Apples and anvils. Let's get our only break of the hour. We're going to come back with Professor Randy Stone and get your phone calls in. We also want to make sure we squeeze in just his perspective on what our lack of commitment to the Paris Treaty on climate change and, in generally speaking, our lack of commitment in, with our allies regarding climate means going forward. So we'll hit that and your phone calls coming up. Coming up in our second hour, we'll tell you about the Metal Trades Project, a collaborative endeavor of area BOCES and Metal Trades programs. And we're going to take a look at skilled trades in particular. What do the numbers say about hiring, employment opportunities? You'll meet some students who are deciding on careers and looking at skilled trades for their own future. Is this the right time, especially with the economy in the shape it's in? We'll talk about it next hour. All right, welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Back to the phones we go, and Don in East Rochester is next. Go ahead, Don.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would inquire of the professor to put himself in Vladimir Putin's shoes. I mean, I have a lot of disagreements with Vladimir Putin. Don't get me wrong. But if you're the Russian government and you all of a sudden see an alliance that was created to fight you in 1949, steadily moving eastward, Poland becomes a member, the Czech Republic, and then the Baltic states become members of NATO. Now NATO is poised a few hundred miles from St. Petersburg. How would you react if you were Vladimir Putin watching this happen? What would have happened if instead of having NATO as an organization that exists, let's say the Warsaw Pact were to still exist? What would the United States' response be if Canada or Mexico wanted to join the Warsaw Pact? It would be the same thing. You're seeing an alliance that is dedicated to controlling or confining Russia, and Vladimir Putin has every reason to be upset with that. Also, I would like to say Donald Trump's bad behavior in Europe, I would hate to be the Montenegrin prime minister and being pushed out of the way so he can get center stage. That's an ignorant five-year-old. But Vladimir Putin has every reason to be concerned. Now, like I said, there's lots of things wrong with Vladimir Putin. Don't get me wrong. But on this issue, he has every right to be concerned.
Okay. Thank you, Don. Appreciate the phone call. What do you think?
No, thanks, Don. You know, I was very skeptical, particularly of the second wave of NATO expansion. The first wave, you know, included countries like Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, and so forth, who were, it was not as threatening to Russian security as bringing into NATO countries that, as you mentioned, you know, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, that are a stone's throw from St. Petersburg. And I think that you're right, absolutely, that the origins of U.S.-Russia tensions were laid at that point. Though if Yeltsin had been succeeded by someone who were not, a former KGB officer and former head of the KGB, and if Putin had not been someone who wanted to put people from the KGB who were his cronies in all the major positions of power and then control the state and turn it into an authoritarian regime, things could have worked out very differently. So the expectation in the Clinton administration when NATO was expanding was that Russia would continue to be a democratic state with whom we had good relations, and so this would not lead to this kind of sharpening of tensions that it has in fact led to. But the overwhelming majority of Russians, and particularly Russian foreign policy experts, always regarded NATO expansion as very threatening and never believed the Western assurances, which I think were very genuinely intended, that NATO was not really a threatening alliance. It's a defensive alliance, and that NATO has lots of other purposes besides military purposes, and you know that has a political role. There was a partnership for peace, which for a while even included Russia as a candidate member, and there was talk talk of perhaps Russia joining NATO someday, right? So there was this kind of optimistic, naive perspective on the Western side, which for the most part the Russians never bought into. Things then got sharpened under the George W. Bush administration, when Bush pushed very hard for NATO to agree to admitting Georgia and Ukraine as members. Now, that's the kind of thing that an American president can do. They can get our allies to do things that they're really skeptical about, because the United States is the biggest player. They really want to get along with the United States. They can rely on a great deal of deference. Even when we're wrongheaded. And that was very wrongheaded. It led directly to the 2008 war between Russia and Georgia, and then I think also precipitated some of the crisis over Ukraine that we're seeing now.
Herman in Brighton on the phone next. Go ahead, Herman.
I have two questions. First of all, what can any individual voter do to try to get the Trump administration to stay in the Paris Climate Accord? I've already emailed Scott Pruitt. I doubt it'll do much good, but of course it's not something that Congress has any say in, so we can't get our senators and representatives to put pressure on them. It won't, they're not involved in that. So what can we do about that? The other thing is, I would love to have your assessment of Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. He's obviously a capable businessman, but I'm a little worried that he's having to learn on the job at a time when we're facing a lot of crises. And I'm particularly concerned that, as far as I know, there's nobody at the top levels of either the State or the Defense Department that is expert on North Korea. I think that the Defense Secretary is familiar with the Middle East, but Mattis is familiar with the Middle East. But I don't know that there's anybody that really understands North Korea, at least not at the top levels. So I'd love to have your assessment of Tillerson in particular.
All right, Herman, thank you. Let's work backwards and start with Rex Tillerson. What do you think?
So Rex Tillerson, I think, it's mixed, right? He clearly aligns with the group in the administration that's more associated with realpolitik, so people like McMaster. He's not ideological. Right? And he's tried to walk back a lot of the sort of inflammatory things and sort of poorly thought out initiatives that Trump has thrown out. So I think he's been a calming influence. On the other hand, his inexperience in government has really shown, and he's had a very embarrassing performance on his foreign trips. His first foreign trip was to Turkey. He brought a whole bunch of concessions to Turkey, and he was hoping that he could get some sort of working cooperation going. And the Turkish leaders that he met with simply stood there and lectured him in public at their press conference and made him look really weak and ineffective. So that was a very poor performance. Then he had a very poor performance when he went to China. He went without any of his own press corps. Whenever the Secretary of State goes somewhere, they take their press corps along so that they can control the storyline. Right? If you don't have any of your own press corps, then the Chinese have complete control over the storyline. And he again came and made all sorts of embarrassing concessions. There are certain formulations in U.S. foreign policy towards China which have been accepted for decades, and the Chinese know that they don't particularly like them, but they know what they are. And he gave up on some of those things, certain nuances about how we talk about Taiwan and so forth, and about human rights, the Chinese would be willing to accept the status quo. He sort of freely gave up a lot of those positions, and the Chinese, of course, were very pleased by this, but he didn't get anything in return. If you make all those concessions, you ought to get something at least, right? So I think he's shown a lot of ineffectiveness. The other thing is, this is true throughout the Trump administration, they haven't made any of the high-level appointments below the cabinet level. So you're still working, either you're working with holdovers from the Obama administration, or you're working with their deputies who aren't political appointees and don't really have the authority to make decisions. And that's true in defense. It's true in Treasury, true in the State Department. So all of these administration, all of these parts of the executive branch are just paralyzed. And this is always a bit of a problem in a presidential transition, but nobody's done it anything like as badly as the Trump administration has.
He had brought up climate, and we saw, you know, Merkel was responding to, I think, Trump's lack of commitment on Paris and climate change. Trump, like a game show host, tweeted after his trip, he's going to make his final decision next week on Paris, you know, like, stay tuned. It's just so strange. But I don't think a lot of people are expecting much commitment to Paris going forward. What do you make of not only Paris, but what it means to our allies that we don't have a firm commitment on climate now?
Right. I mean, my read on this is that if he'd been intending to back off and stay in the climate change accord, this would have been the time to announce it.
Everyone would have been slapping him on the back.
That's nice, right. Moment, yeah. And as a transactional politician, he would have probably figured out a way to get something for it. Right. So this was the time to make the announcement. The only reason to hold off on the official decision is it makes it a little bit harder for them to openly criticize him. Right? It sort of it allows them to blunt the or divert some of the narrative. So I think the decision he's going to make is that he's going to withdraw from it. And I think the Europeans understood that. And that's why they were so sour with him. The irony about this is he's withdrawing from a non-binding commitment, right? The Paris Accord, it's not a treaty, hasn't been ratified. It was never intended to be binding. Every country said what they thought they could do, right? And there are no consequences if you don't actually implement what you said you thought you could do. So he could very well stay in it and say, well, we're still working on what we're going to do and it might change. That would be perfectly legitimate within the framework of the accord. The one thing you can do to violate is to withdraw from it, right? Because the rules say you can't do that without giving a year notice and so forth and so on. So he's managed to figure out the only way to violate what was a purely symbolic commitment in such a way as to deliberately stick your finger in everybody's eye. And 195 countries have joined this thing. It's remarkable.
Before we go, a couple of quick points here. We mentioned at the beginning of the hour there was, kind of trying to get a read on how the world is reacting to the president's foreign trip and what the German newspaper of record said. And then I saw the picture today of a number of PMs, prime ministers who were, I think it was, by the way, Meghan Mac, the Nordic PMs, who were trolling President Trump. There's a picture of I think five or six. Have you seen the picture of them making fun of the orb? The picture that's going around today. I think they're holding a soccer ball, but they are. They're. It's the prime ministers of Denmark, Norway, Finland, Sweden, and Iceland all touching the orb, except for the soccer ball, but in a way to make fun of it. I just can't imagine previous presidents being trolled that way by world leaders. After a foreign trip. It just the dynamic strikes me as people say, well, it's just a joke, but it feels, a little bit like, what can we do to make fun of the American president, which is a weird time to be in. Maybe I'm overreading that one, Randy, but what do you think?
It was a very strange picture, right?
It was
really, really bizarre. He doesn't seem to know how to behave. And he doesn't seem to have anyone around him who knows how to coach him on how to behave. So there were stories about him asking leaders, "Oh, well, so what's the protocol here?" Mm-hmm. Right, during a photo shoot, and these things are negotiated in advance. I mean, why is it that the American president always gets to be front and center? Right, this is negotiated. They have people whose full-time job it is in the State Department to make sure the American president is always full-time center at every G7. Conference. You don't have to elbow the Montenegrin president out of the way because, he knows where to stand. You just try not to run into him.
So this is a little more ham-fisted. Well, in our last 30 seconds, a serious question then. What is your biggest concern if Donald Trump remains president for 4 years or 8 years? Your biggest foreign policy concern is what? What is a worst case? 30 seconds.
Oh, boy. A worst case. I mean, there was a recent article in Foreign Affairs that spun out scenarios of where we might end up in war. And there was one in the South China Sea where we end up at war with China. There was one in North Korea where we end up at war with North Korea. There was one where we end up in war with Russia. I think all of those are possible. They would be very unlikely kind of black swan events under another administration. They're still unlikely, but that would be the worst case scenario, that just through sheer ham-fistedness and lack of understanding and so forth, he provokes an international conflict.
Okay. We're all going to sleep well tonight. Thank you, Randy Stone, the director of the Scully Center for Polish and Central European Studies. Listen, I always learn a lot from you, and we are doing our best to bring in people with real expertise to help us understand the world. So thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan. Sorry to disturb your sleep.
He didn't say those things are likely, by the way. Short break, more Connections next.